I'm Maxine McHugh, and this is Talking Teaching.
When I told my parents that I wanted to go into teaching, they were thrilled. Naturally, there's always other people that were like, you know, why don't you go into law or why don't you do economics? Or, you know, I guess there's that sort of pressure in terms of, I guess, a lot of migrant children.
Real superheroes are teachers.
We were really, really honoured to have one of our staff members.
I was really excited to have her as my teacher for this year.
She just, like, makes the class, like, really fun.
One of the constants in our discussions on this podcast is the need to celebrate and reward teaching. And it's heartening to see the expansion of philanthropic and other awards that recognise excellence in the classroom. But it's probably hard to beat a global teaching prize where the winner is announced by Hugh Jackman and the trophy and cheque for $1 million is handed over by a Middle Eastern crown prince. Backed by the Varkey Foundation, the 2019 Ceremony for Global Teaching Excellence was held recently in Dubai and brought together the top 10 teachers from around the world. Among them was an Australian teacher, Yesudhe Selvakumaran. Yesudhe teaches humanities at Rooty Hill High School in Sydney's western suburbs. Now, this is the fourth year that Australia has made the cut for this prestigious prize. Last year, maths whiz Eddie Wu competed for the top prize, which suggests that in a highly competitive field, and there were 10,000 nominations, Australia's most outstanding teachers are certainly being noticed. Well, after she returned from an action-packed set of events in Dubai, I caught up with Yesudhe Selvakumaran. Yesudhe, first of all, congratulations for the really terrific recognition that has come your way. Now, you're part of a globally connected network of teachers as a result of this, and I know your time in Singapore last year. So, can you tell us, what is it that your overseas counterparts are picking up on about our approach to teaching?
Thank you so much, Maxine. Yes, as a Commonwealth Bank Teaching Award Fellow from last year, awarded with Schools Plus, I had the opportunity to go to Singapore. I also had the opportunity to go to Norway in January using some of the professional learning grant I'd received as part of that award to go to the International Congress for School Effectiveness and Improvement. And then as a top 10 finalist in the Global Teacher Prize, I had the opportunity to go to Dubai. So in this last year, I've definitely had this international immersion and introduction to some fantastic networks in education. And it's interesting that in all three of those contexts, I've heard my colleagues overseas, you know, say that they look to Australia in particular for our approach to critical and creative thinking and innovative approaches to driving dispositions and capabilities. And outdoor education is another one that was mentioned by Singapore. It just shows that in Australia, we're really doing some really amazing things and there's some shifts being recognised by colleagues overseas. And I think that we could be doing more to celebrate those back here at home.
So it's interesting they're picking up on our approach to, I think, what we're calling now the general capabilities or the complex competencies. It's another term for them. How do you do that with your students at Rooty Hill?
At Rooty Hill, I'm part of a much broader team that's been looking at the work of the Australian curriculum capabilities for some time now. And we actually have a number of approaches in the way that we do this. We've got a whole school learning platform called the Rooty Hill High School Creativity Wheel, which really looks at how do we embed strategies like visible learning and thinking routines into our work. And what that looks like as a teacher is we have those visible in every single classroom. There's various strategies that we link to particular dispositions of creativity. And this is been developed in partnership with Dr. Bill Lucas at the University of Winchester, who the school has worked with for some time. And as a history teacher and humanities teacher, in my classroom, I really focus on really being able to get students to grapple with various problems and inquiry-based learning in history and how they can use different approaches to visualise, to empathise, and to connect and justify where their ideas and responses are coming from. But it's definitely been a huge amount of work by a very collaborative team here for some time now that has made us a school that people want to visit. We host a number of school visits every year, and there's been a lot of interest in this work in particular.
How do you balance, if you like, disciplinary knowledge with the approach you're describing?
This is actually something that's part of our current school plan, where I'm co-leading a project with a colleague, really looking at how do we develop disciplinary expertise with a focus on Year 10, 11 and 12. In the junior school, we've deliberately used the word capabilities in our focus, and it's really looking at, well, how can we be innovative within our discipline? And in history, for example, it's a lot of inquiry-based approaches, but really we're working backwards from the professions, taking on Lee Shulman's ideas, which are applied more to a tertiary context, to look at new ways of knowing, doing and being. And I guess it has created different types of assessment, like students in Year 10 creating like a policy response, for example, in the topic of terrorism in Year 10 elective history. Students doing things like pitching an idea for a museum and really exploring the issues of what is it that makes public history and what are the stories that are missed out or marginalised, and you know, how can we propose that some of those stories be elevated and why, and justifying that. So it's really looking at the kinds of jobs, I guess, that students would be going into if they're interested in these particular fields, and trying to embed that as part of our assessment and our daily work.
And what is this doing for student engagement in getting them to apply and grapple with knotty problems on the basis of what they do know?
Oh, it's absolutely given students, I guess, a more real-world context to be able to really explore what sorts of jobs, you know, that they could potentially go into. And sometimes, you know, students don't necessarily make the link between why history is an important discipline if they want to work in, say, foreign policy or media or government. And this is giving them that exposure. And by giving them that real world applicability, they're much more engaged. But it also gives students an opportunity to really think about their own values and their place within the world, and sharing that with their peers. And yeah, those two particular assessments I mentioned, we've been running for a number of years as students have rated them in feedback that we get from them as being, you know, one of their most favourite assessment tasks, but also being one that really helped shift their learning.
Yesterday, to come to Dubai, which must have been wonderful on so many levels,
yes.
I gather you took part in a research workshop with the top 50 finalists from around the world. So tell us about that.
Yes, it was actually part of a leadership summit that the Varkey Foundation funded the top 50 finalists, but also there was another 50 there from previous years that had been finalists who were back presenting research projects that they'd been a part of, and they'd made connections through this network that we're now in called the Varkey Teacher Ambassadors. So the current top 50 from 2019, I guess the audience were listening to what the previous finalists had been doing as a result of their connections through the network, and that was just fantastic to see. I'm constantly looking at how we can try and be advocates to bridge research and practice in education. I really enjoy working with pre-service teachers and also contributing to teacher-led research at Reedy Hill High School. And yeah, so for me, that was a definite highlight of that leadership summit, and being able to see the opportunities that there are to continually grow from here. So I'm seeing this as just the beginning of something that's really quite exciting.
I bet. Was there much discussion from your peers around the issue of engagement? Because as you know, in so many of our schools, what teachers are grappling with is those students who disengage from learning, perhaps at an early stage, and it's hard to get them back.
Yes. Do you mean internationally or here?
Either in Australia or internationally.
Actually, at both, in terms of forums and events that I've been to. The issue of engagement, really, at a global level, what I saw in Dubai was about how do we connect all students, you know, into learning from all different contexts and backgrounds. And the idea really came to that we need to be, you know, doing more to be able to cater for students' backgrounds and their particular interests, but how do we balance that with, I guess, technology as a tool and all of these issues that we talk about in Australia as well. But there were some fantastic examples of how people had done that being shared as well throughout the forum.
I want to ask about technology use as well. Was there any consensus or concern among your colleagues about perhaps the traps of too much screen time for young people? Did that come up?
A lot of people talking about how technology was used, but making sure as well that there was the idea that we don't just use technology for the sake of it. And there was definitely concerns about screen time being shared. But in other parts of the world, you know, they don't even have access to technology. So that's, I guess, you know, in terms of that global context of what was discussed in Dubai, there was two very different streams going on. And interestingly, people talking about how in some countries, it's almost like students have missed having computers, but they've now got mobile devices in terms of the way that technology has spread, and looking at learning through using mobile apps and things like that as well.
So look, just to finish, I'm just wondering about the things that perhaps set you on your course. I gather that there are teachers in the family, and you went to a regional public school in New South Wales,
yes,
to Bathurst, is that right?
It is right. I did actually go to a private school for a year and three terms as a scholarship student in Year 7 and 8, but then it was quite expensive, and I did go back to the public school, and that was the system that I was in all throughout primary. And I think for me, yeah, definitely having teachers in the family, but really seeing the role of teachers in a regional town in particular, seeing that they were more than just teachers in our school, it was really about their influence in the community and being role models, and that shift really did inspire me. But I was also very passionate about the humanities and history in particular, and I really realised, and this has definitely informed the way that I teach history, that for me growing up, I didn't actually feel like that we had opportunities to explore my heritage or even, you know, many stories about particular, like, migration and as part of Australia's history. And it's something that I strive for in terms of developing my students, is that they understand their own place in the world and how their history is a part of Australia as well, and how we can learn and share from each other, and especially in the environment that I work in, where 50% of our students come from a non-English speaking background, makes it very, very rich to be able to share and understand and be able to live together harmoniously.
Yesterday, I'm sensing there's a whole book in this that you're going to use someday. But look, for the moment, congratulations. You've got a crowded year ahead, so all the very best.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for highlighting some of the work that we're doing at Broody Hill High School as well.
Well, now to the view of someone who has spent a significant part of his career working out how the system can better produce and support purposeful leaders, ones just like yesterday, Silva Kumaran. Bruce Armstrong is a principal turned bureaucrat, most recently in the Victorian Department of Education. His strong interest is in how to equip principals with the capabilities needed to lead effective school change. And that saw him appointed in 2009 as the inaugural director of the Bastow Institute of Educational Leadership. Bruce Armstrong, welcome to Talking Teaching.
Thank you for having me, Maxine. It's good to be with you.
Now, you're at a interesting transition point in your long career in education, so I'm keen to get your helicopter view, as it were, of Australian schooling. What do you think we're doing well, and what are the deficits?
I think we're doing many things well. I think that, the Australian system is often talked down, and we can't talk universally about an Australian system when we look to the outcomes in the OECD and the OECD rankings through PISA and PIRLS and TIMS. We often compare ourselves poorly against other high-performing jurisdictions. But there's many things that are going well across Australia, and there are, in every jurisdiction, examples of excellence in schools and in teaching practice across our country. I think we've been slipping back. The thing that we're not doing well is on the equity side. Where you're born, who you're born to, and what postcode you live in terms of socioeconomic advantage or disadvantage are strong determinants of schooling outcome in Australia. And that is something that we really need to tackle that we're not doing well. But there are many things, both in terms of the Australian curriculum, our pedagogical approaches, and our approaches to school improvement jurisdictionally, that we're doing well.
Bruce, I'll come to some of those issues and we'll explore those. But I want to ask first about, if you like, the institution that you've just come from the bureaucracy, if you like, as a deputy secretary in the Victorian Department. What about our systems, the bureaucracies? Are they responding well enough to the needs of leaders in schools?
I've had a very privileged career, having been a teacher and principal and then moved into the bureaucracy, working at a regional level and then working in the central office. And the thing that I would say is that there are good people, well-intentioned, focused on improving outcomes for learners at every level of the system. I think that that would probably be true in every jurisdiction in Australia, certainly my personal experience. I think that one of the challenges for central bureaucracies is to be attuned to the professionals that teach and support that teaching, our educational support staff, our teachers and our school leaders, to really privilege the place of practice, to understand the contingent nature of teaching and the expertise that's required, and to see that as a site of learning for policy development. Naturally, central bureaucracies are geared towards supporting ministers and government and all the nuances of working in that interface between a department and the political realm. But the place of learning is the place of practice, and having a very strong student-centred focus in all of the endeavours around policy.
What are the tendency, though, for the participants in whatever area they're in, whether in schools or in the bureaucracy, for those to distrust each other or be suspicious of each other, misunderstand each other?
Yeah, it's interesting. My experience is that you tend to blame a level above you. So when you're a teacher, it's the principal or the school leadership team. Principals complain about the region or the centre. And we talk about departments as if we're not all part of one department. The workforce in schools belongs to the department. It's part of the department. Regional workforce is a part of the department. Centrally located corporate staff are part of the department. I think it's creating a learning system. How are we learning from and with each other at every level of the system so that there are powerful feedback loops, and having a very, very strong service and learning orientation at any level that's outside of the classroom, because that's what the whole endeavour is to support. The professionals that are teaching our young people, our children and young people in early childhood settings, in kindergartens, in primary schools and secondary schools and TAFEs, our focus needs to be on what do we need to help them do their work very well.
So from your experience in Victoria, are we getting better at that?
I think we're getting much better at it, and it requires a stance of listening and building trust through relationships. There is mistrust, I think, of bureaucracies, and part of that is due to the lurches in policy across the electoral cycle that creates mistrust and disinterest and disengagement from the profession. Governments change, as ministers change sometimes too, as they want to put their stamps on things.
I suppose that's something we can learn from other jurisdictions. Singapore is often cited, a very different governance model, I know, but it does produce much greater policy continuity, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that this is where this issue around policy and its interaction with evidence is really important. Can we get kind of bilateral agreement around the things that sit at the core of the endeavour, around what helps a school improve, how to invest in leadership, how to invest in the professional learning of teachers, how to help teachers draw upon evidence and gauge the impact on learner outcomes for the children that they're teaching. So I think that's part of what breeds this mistrust. So when in Victoria you ask the question about how are we doing, well, it takes time to re-establish those relationships, to re-establish trust. And that starts with listening. It starts with recognising that there's a relational dimension to change and improvement. It's not just about policy. It's about a set of things that you need to do to garner people's will to walk with you on a journey of improvement.
Let's talk about schools, because a lot of your work has been around the key issue of transformation in schools. And I know you often cite the key criteria documented by Harvard professor Richard Elmore. Now, are more of our schools, Bruce, do you think, working to this formula?
His proposition was really that there are three things that are required, which is the quality, the intellectual demand of the curriculum, if you like, what students are taught, the professional expertise of the teachers who teach it, and the agency of students over their own learning, that interaction between the content, the teacher and the student. Absolutely critical to the equation, or the other trilogy, curriculum, pedagogy and assessment, and how it comes together to create environments of powerful learning for children and young people in the settings in which they're learning, creating a community of learners. So I think we're on the right track. We're focused on the right things in Victoria around improving the pedagogical enactment, the Victorian curriculum being supported in its implementation, and increasingly through the release of the document Amplify, how do we amplify student voice, agency and leadership at every stage of schooling so that students feel that they have some control over what they're learning and how they're learning it.
My sense is that, in fact, there is, as you say, a good understanding of what needs to be done. But typically, what goes wrong, do you think, Bruce? Is it, we'll say, a well-intentioned start where perhaps it's driven just by the sole leader in the school, the principal? What happens when things go wrong?
I think that it's multifaceted. Often school communities, teachers, principals, leadership teams can be overwhelmed by the circumstances that they find themselves in, the populations and communities that they're serving, with complex and diverse needs, culturally and linguistically diverse communities, refugee communities, Koori communities, the impacts of socioeconomic disadvantage on communities, rural and regional isolation can play a factor. So I don't think it's one thing. It can be many things. But I think leadership here becomes a pivotal thing, the role of the principal, you won't find an improving school or a school that's transforming in the absence of good leadership. Not sole leadership, but an enabling leadership, a coaching leadership, one that's building the capacity of other leaders and of teacher leaders and of all teachers in and support staff in their school community. So that when it's going well, that's what it looks like. In its absence, it's often poor or leadership over a period of time, maybe rapid turnover in complex settings where there's been a churn of leadership. And as a consequence, the teaching staff become dispirited and the community becomes alienated or loses confidence in its local school community.
Now, you've mentioned the issues of rural and regional Australia a couple of times. And of course, everything you've just described is amplified for that part of Australia, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that the issues of regional towns and centres and the impacts of rural, we don't really have remote in Victoria, but we have rural, the issues around attracting staff, attracting leaders into our schools in rural and regional Victoria, and that's true across Australia as well, that it's the issue of attraction and retention of capable people into those settings. What are the incentives? What are the drivers to attract people into those communities? How do we leverage technology for virtual learning so that high-quality online content and engagement through both synchronous and asynchronous can be used to kind of overcome the tyranny of distance and give students options in their pathways, which I think is one of the critical things for young people in rural and regional centres. They don't often see the pathways because they don't have the subject choice.
We've been conscious of this for a very long time. What then are the barriers to producing more interesting incentive packages?
Yeah, so I think some of it is funding and then thinking out what are the mix of incentives that would be enough to attract and retain people. Back in the day, we had housing that was available in our rural and regional centres to provide an incentive for people to go and move. When there was centralised staffing, people would start in the country and move back towards the metropolitan areas. So I think thinking about what are the financial incentives, what are the community-based incentives in terms of lifestyle and choice that need to be promulgated. But there are policy levers in there that I think can be used, and I think it will require a national effort. It's not something that's just happening in Victoria. It's happening across the country, the challenges of it. And I'm not sure that we've really got to the point where we're really thinking seriously about how high-performing teachers can be used synchronously into classrooms remotely and in rural to provide options. I mean, that's being tinkered with in Victoria. How do we do that well? And how do we create and curate high-quality online content for students who, because of distance, are really suffering the disadvantages of subject choice?
Would you go so far as to say we really need a sense of national urgency about this?
I do. I think that this is another issue around the equity equation. We need to have a sense of access for everyone to a high-quality education as being a superordinate principle to design our policy settings.
The other area that Richard Elmore talks about is changing the relationship of students to learning. And there's a lot of discussion about this in schools now. What does this look like when it's happening in a very buzzy, positive way?
Look, I think there's lots of things that are happening in schools where teachers have taken hold of this issue around engagement. What does it mean to engage young people in their learning? And relevance is absolutely key here. I mean, this is not a new discussion either. You know, this goes right back into, you know, when Dewey was writing about the child and pedagogy and curriculum. What does a child-centred view look like? How do you engage the learner? And relevance triggers intrinsic motivation to learn. And it becomes more critical as children move into early adolescence and mid-adolescence and late adolescence in upper primary and early secondary schooling, when we see profound levels of disengagement. And I believe that that is connecting learning to real life issues beyond the school gate, engaging them in the ways that they learn natively when they're on their own outside the gate, but connecting them to authentic problems to get them to learn deeply with others in teams, to connect to community, to create relevance. I think these are really pivotal things that are happening where you see that buzz in classrooms and school communities.
The other continuing debate, of course, is around initial teacher training and the issue of higher entry standards. Now, we've certainly got some of the states moving in this direction. How do we weed out the ill-suited candidate, perhaps earlier in the system?
This has been a really interesting public debate, and it's been quite a polarising one, hasn't it, this issue of who gets selected into teaching. I'll tackle it with a slightly different frame. I think that if you think about preparing young people to teach, what does that look like? And it requires an end-to-end system. What does attraction and recruitment look like into pre-service? That's happening in upper high school, probably mid-high school, when families and carers are having conversations with young people about their pathways. It starts there. Is teaching seen to be a high-quality, valuable profession in our culture? And I don't think it is. I'm not sure that we've got a cultural bias towards teachers. I think it's shifting in the knowledge economy to be a really highly esteemed profession, like it is in high-performing jurisdictions. You mentioned Singapore before, but you can think of Nordic countries, think of Sweden and Finland, where teaching is seen to be a noble profession, an honourable profession, a valued profession. And I think that that's where you start, because that's on the attraction side. It's a worthwhile thing to do.
Does that mean much higher entry standards?
Go directly to your point about then it goes to the issue of suitability. Can you predict suitability is the question through entrance. And I think that we should have a desire to have highly able and capable people in our profession. Why wouldn't we? I mean, these are the people who are teaching people for all of the future professions and trades. These are the people that are igniting curiosity and creativity and building in social skills into our future generations. We should want really highly capable people who have the right set of soft skills or emotional intelligence and relational skills combined with the intellectual capacity to grapple with developing content knowledge and understanding how children and young people learn and how you create the enabling conditions for that to happen. That's complex, demanding, challenging work that needs to last a career. And so you've got this issue around an end-to-end system is attraction and recruitment. It's pre-service in universities, and that's been quite fraught around cutoffs around ATAR and so on. It should not be. We should be seeking to get the most able into our profession. You wouldn't be having this conversation with most other professions, psychology, engineering, architecture, law, medicine, to name a few. This doesn't seem to be a debate because we expect that people will be highly able going into those professions.
Bruce, if we were to move to something like that, would it mean that we were training fewer teachers?
Supply becomes an issue as you raise the bar to entry. People then become concerned on the supply side. And it's often used in kind of a fearful way. Don't go there because you'll block supply. I think that you need to face into that and say, yes, there could be supply side issues. So then what is the policy mix of incentives around scholarships and attraction for rural and regional candidates, for supporting people while they're going through pre-service education in particular disciplines that might be in short supply? So you need a supply side strategy. But I don't think that you should therefore balk at the issue around the quality of the candidate that's going in and the quality of the graduates that are coming out from pre-service into teaching, into graduate teaching. And then we need to mentor and support them because that's the beginning of their learning in the place of practice that was only in part in the professional experience or practicum within the university setting. So it's a continuum from recruitment, pre-service and in-service induction, mentoring and ongoing learning.
And just on that last point, that's where it seems to me we're still pretty hit and miss, the extent to which fresh teachers are supported in a new school environment.
Yes, and I think that when we don't attend to that issue of what does it mean to be inducted into a profession and we put all the heavy lifting on the university providers, they feel that they're being beaten up on. Everybody's responsible here and the profession has a responsibility to induct its graduates into its profession. I think that we induct people into sites and schools. I'm not sure that we induct people into a profession. What does that look like? Providing time for mentoring, time for the most able teachers in a setting to mentor our graduate teachers. And I think that that's really critical to be taking that seriously. And Victoria is doing some really important work and to be taking cohorts of graduates and bringing them together in various ways so that they know that they're growing into the professional standards, their professional knowledge, their professional practice, their professional ethics, not just what's the hour duty look like at this particular primary school? Where do I find out about the extras? How does the timetable work? These are all the kind of operational things in a particular context, but there are bigger issues of what it means to become an educational professional.
Bruce, it's always good to talk to you, and let me thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on these big issues in education, and all the very best for this next phase of your life.
Thank you, Maxine. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's it for Talking Teaching this month. This podcast has been produced at the Horwood Studios at the University of Melbourne. Our sound engineer is Gavin Naber, who also composed our theme music. Bye for now.